This is Alex Kraner.
This is Dave Collum.
This is Bruce Party.
Hi, this is Jeremy McKenzie, the Raging Dissident.
Hello, this is Maxime Bernier.
This is Danny Bulford.
This is Chuck Prodnick.
This is Vance Crowe, and you're listening to the Sean Newman Podcast.
Welcome to the podcast, folks. Happy Friday. How's everybody doing? Let's go. Government deficits running out of control. Yep. Now might be the perfect time to diversify some of your hard-earned savings into physical money that can't be printed. I'm talking gold and silver. Of course, I'm talking silver, gold, bull. They offer a full suite of services to help you buy, sell, and store your precious metals. They ship right to your metal. Ship your metal discreetly. Oh boy, it's Friday. Fully insured and with tracking straight to you. I was texting with Graham. That's right. We're texting now. We're texting about the Canadian Mint Silver Maple Leaf, the Royal Canadian Mint Silver Maple Leaf. They got a deal going on with there. Super easy. Just shoot a text over to Graham. He'll hook you up with all that. If you aren't interested in silver and gold, totally fine. Would appreciate, though, if you'd shoot him a text. No different than you'd shoot me a text. Anytime you're like, man, thanks for supporting the show and helping Sean do what he does, helping the S&P do what it does, would appreciate you shooting Graham a text and saying, hey, thanks to Silver Gold Bull for supporting independent media, for supporting the Sean Newman Podcast. Either way, if you've never checked out Silver Gold Bull, you have no idea what I'm talking about. Silvergoldbull.ca. That's where you can find out all the details. Calrock, your trusted partner in surplus oil field equipment, leading supplier of new, used, and reconditioned oil field production equipment in Canada, but that's not all. Tank fabrication, new and refurbished fluid storage tanks, trucking, pump jacks, and demolition. Calrock.ca. Rectech Power Products, for over 20 years, they've been committed to excellence in the power sports industry. They offer a full lineup, including Can-Am, Ski-Doo, Sea-Doo, Spyder, Mercury, Evinrude, Mahindra Roxer. They're open Monday through Saturday. If you haven't been to the west side of Lloydminster to check out their showroom, you don't know what you're missing. Spring is around the corner. They got golf carts. They got a whole lot of stuff. Super cool. Take a little peek. Ignite Distribution out of Wainwright, Alberta. They can supply industrial, safety, welding, automotive parts. They got on-site inventory management. So if you want to make sure you never run out of whatever it is that makes you run, Shane Stafford is a pure beauty. Give him a call, 780-842-3433. We have the, as you're going to hear in today's episode, we have the S&P Cornerstone Forum. It's going to feature Tom and Alex along with a whole cast of characters. There was 23 tickets rolling. Actually, that's a lie. And I'm going to check. And just like that, we're 21 tickets. 21 tickets. So, you know, the tickets are disappearing. There isn't that many left. If you want to get your hands on a ticket, get in the building for Saturday, April 27th. I would suggest you go in the show notes, showpass.com/cornerstone. Buy your tickets today. There's still the ability to buy a table while the numbers still work out. So you can do that. And then if you're not interested or you can't come to April 27th, April 28th is going to have at the Moose Lodge here in Lloydminster, you're going to have the Cowboy Preacher, Cam Milliken, Tanner Nadeau on stage. Kids are welcome. We got a room downstairs where we're going to have some activities for them. That way, if you're like, well, what am I going to do with the kids on Sunday morning? They can come as well. That's going to be at the Moose Lodge here in Lloydminster, 9 a.m. That's going to be a fun day. Hope to see you that weekend. Now, let's get on to that tale of the tape. The first is a former research chemist, amateur dairy goat farmer, libertarian, and economist whose work can be found on sites like Zero Hedge and Newsmax Media. He also hosts the Golds, Goats, and Guns podcast. The second, Croatian national, former hedge fund manager, author, and contributing editor at Zero Hedge. I'm talking about Tom Luongo and Alex Kraner. So buckle up. Here we go. Welcome to the Sean Newman Podcast. Today, I'm joined by Tom Luongo, Alex Kraner for the 12th time, boys. It's been a year. It's been roughly once a year now. Once a month. So thanks for hopping on, guys.
Always a pleasure. Always fun, Sean.
You know, I'm going to say this right at the start because you guys are coming. You know, if there was one place, folks, they probably never thought they would grace once. That'd probably be Lloydminster. And if they thought they'd ever grace the same land twice, Lloydminster, April 27th, They're coming back. Tom, Alex, among a cast of characters, and it's pretty cool. This morning, I'm down to 24 tickets left. So wow. It's looking like it's going to be a full house for the Saturday. It's going to have some interesting people there. Once again, if you haven't grabbed a ticket and you're in the area, you probably only got a couple more days. I think it's been, down about 50 in the last 7 days, something like that. So there's not a whole lot left. 24, and I just hopped on. It might be 23. I might have missed one. And so that's pretty cool. Either way, looking forward to having you boys back here in April. That all being said, let's start with...
Mental note, must start writing speech.
It's going to be fun. Before we get too deep into today, the interesting thing for yourselves, you come on this show and you're always together for the most part. I've had Tom on once since we started having both of you together. We talked Star Wars and different things. And I've had Alex on once talking basically the Tucker Putin interview, although we talked some different things. So normally you're together at this event. Certainly you're both going to be in the building, but I got some interesting things cooked up to hopefully pull some different thoughts out of both of you. And hopefully for anyone in attendance, that should be a ton of fun to be in the building for. I don't know what your guys' thoughts are on coming back to Lloydminster. How about we just start with the Cornerstone Forum and see what you boys think of coming back to Lloydminster?
Go ahead, Alex.
Oh, I can't wait. I'm very excited to go. And, last time was phenomenal. It was so much fun and so interesting and met so many great people there. It wasn't hard for me to decide to go again.
Now, the hardest part for us was just the logistics of getting everybody wrangled, right? To find the right weekend where everybody was able to go. But, when Sean said, would you be willing to come up in late April? I'm like, the first time he asked us, was my daughter's 18th birthday. And I'm like, well, I can't do that one, but pretty much any other weekend I can do. So, I'm looking forward to it in a way that is almost, I guess we're upgrading this last time, it's going to be, it's a little bit more responsibility now than the last time. It was just like, well, I get to be on the stage with Alex and Sean. I'm not really sure what's going on. It'll be a Q&A. The Q&As are easy, but when you have to actually have to write a script, be on script, and I'm not particularly good at either of those things. So this will be I've got to make sure I
get well, my and I, I learned a lesson from last time. I'm not putting it in June. Here in Canada, once the snow's gone, you're going to have a tough time wrangling people. It being in April, farmers might be in the field by then. We'll see how April goes here. But certainly April, when it comes to the oil field and different things like that, everybody slows down. Hockey's done. Spring sports haven't started. And so to me, when I look at ticket sales, I go, oh, yeah, that honestly makes sense to me because people can handle this time of year, whereas you get later into it's not June isn't summer, but, Canada, we make the best of the months where the sun's shining, the ground is dry, the days are kind of long. It's like, it can be plus five outside. We're all still, we're all running. And as it sits right now, it's almost t-shirt weather, boys. And it was minus five this morning. I'm thinking, It ain't far off. I'm going to roll into the studio in shorts. Tom's probably laughing at me because he's sitting in Florida.
What I'm really laughing at is that the minute we said it was going to be, we're going to be in April, my wife goes to Amazon and starts buying long underwear because she's like, the wind, dude. It's not that it would be that terrible. I'm from New York, ultimately. I know how to dress for the winter, and I have, and we both have, wool coats because I love wool coats, right? I love cold weather clothing, but I never get to wear it because I live in friggin' Dante's Easy Bake, right? And it's awful. So, this is a great opportunity. I was actually looking at, so what am I going to wear, blah, 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 and actually doing some clothes shopping last night because I'm such a clothes horse. Because, $8 over at Tractor Supply, boys. I upgraded from $6 over at Walmart. Let's do the thing. I'm looking forward to it. It's gonna be fun.
Well, I'm excited to have you boys. Now, today is going to be for the listener, it's going to be a little shorter. We're going to keep everybody on time. There's a lot of different things moving in all of our worlds. So let's get to it. The big thing that happened here just in the last couple of days was the Baltimore Bridge. I don't know where you boys want to start. To me, I just looked at it, I'm like, holy crap. I've watched the videos and everybody's breakdown of it at least, 15 different times. I'm curious what you two thought seeing the Baltimore Bridge get ran into and ultimately cratering, and what that's going to mean here, you know, as we move forward in the months to come.
Well, Alex, I want you to start because I just did 2.5 hours with Kerrigan and Colm and Kunstler, and we talked about all this. So I want to hear what Alex has to say on this.
Well, you know, I saw a bunch of videos of it as well. I find it extremely disturbing, and what you saw immediately is that the FBI came out and said, "Oh, it was an accident," before they could even begin the most preliminary investigation. How do you decide that that was an accident just like that? And then everybody who has some knowledge of this, right? There were guys who posted videos who are like ex-Coast Guards and ex-pilots and so forth. And they were like, no way, no how was this an accident? And what you see in the video is the boat first approaching at very high speed, which I think, you know, I grew up in a port city. When boats go in and out of ports, they go very slowly. And most of the time they use pilot boats, and pilot goes on the ship to help the captains steer the boat into the port, or they use tugboats. So they're always extremely careful about this. This one was going at what looked to me like 20 knots. And then as it approaches the bridge, it swerves sharply, which, you know, ships don't often do, not away from the pylon, but straight into the carry, one of the two load-bearing pylons. I don't know much about steering ships, but if I saw that video, I would say like, well, we need to investigate how this happened. I wouldn't like immediately dismiss it as an accident. And now the importance of, you know, the consequences of this action are very crippling to the U.S. economy, because this is apparently, I only learned this over the last 2 days. This is the second most important traffic roadway for the U.S. economy. Number one port in refined fuels, in cars, hazardous waste, agricultural produce and machinery, and so forth. So it's extraordinarily debilitating for the U.S. economy. It's going to have severe consequences, which, you know, in the world where good news is bad news, you know, stocks should be flying higher, you know, obviously. But I think that in terms of how it affects the real economy, it's going to be a very, very adverse event. And I think that ultimately we'll see the impact also on interest rates. I think that the bonds are going to be heading another leg south based on this. There's always a time delay. You know, markets don't always react instantly, but it does create pressure and it creates a trend. And so it's going to be a very negative event. Now, if it isn't an accident, it was done by on purpose, who might be behind it? That would be interesting to understand, you know? And I think that Tom's going to have a lot to say about this, but I'm sure that we're going to be zeroing in on the same enemy. And I think that we've talked about this before. Mm-hmm. We know that, you know, certain interest groups in this world, City of London, have two scenarios for the United States. A, they control the United States and use it as their bludgeon in the world to, you know, keep up their empire. Or B, if the United States goes independent, then break it up or start Civil War 2.0. Mm-hmm. Same thing that happened in 1861.
So
how do you start that? Well, first you have to, you know, as Kissinger said when they were destroying Chile, you have to make the economy scream first.
Yep.
So You know, if somebody said, like, well, how would we cripple the U.S. economy? You know, and I'm not talking about stocks and Google and Apple and NVIDIA. I'm talking about the real economy, the stuff that gets you food on the table and gets you your car repaired and people things that people depend on. How would you do that? Well, how about crippling the one of the most important traffic networks in the country? Yep. And how easy was that to do? And then it turns out that the captain of the ship is a Ukrainian. Yep. And I don't want to, you know, like, I don't want to put too much weight on that fact. But, you know, the Brits do have a very close relationship with the Ukrainian intelligence. And so, you know, I'm not going to categorically say it was the Brits and the Ukrainian captain was their agent. But if I were FBI, I would investigate that angle, you know, at least find out if there's any, you know, if there's any smoke there, if there's any legs to that story, rather than saying nothing to see here, folks, disperse. This was an accident.
So, Alex, I'm going to see your FBI and I'm going to raise you the Daily Mail.
Okay, go.
Because this thing hits the bridge at 1:26 a.m. local time. By 8:45 local time, Eastern Standard Time, the Daily Mail has a major article up committing multiple acts of journalism. When the fuck did that ever happen? They never... How does the Daily Mail, otherwise known as MI6 Journal, it's like the British equivalent of the Washington Post, right, which is a mouthpiece for the CIA. How did they have, you know, intimate knowledge about what was going on and all this information up and ready for everybody to digest at eight, you know, as they're going to work that morning? Here in America, we haven't even like figured out that this thing happened. Most of us are still just waking up to the idea of what's going on. Like, this is insane.
Yeah.
So yeah, like the Daily Mail article is a massive smoking gun.
Tom, do you know whether it was in print already or whether it was online first?
Just online.
Oh, just online. Okay.
Yeah. Something like 8:45. I was sitting there chatting with my partner in crime, Dexter White, on this. And he was like, dude, when does this happen? I'm like, never.
Yeah.
So, you know, but it's the same thing with what happened in Moscow when, you know, before we go to Moscow, there's a lot of parallels to the way the stories are being disseminated and who's being blamed and blah, 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 blah in each of these instances. There's two ways here. The two most likely scenarios are, one, the Russians did it as response to what happened in Moscow. Let's not kid ourselves. As a piece of fourth generational warfare, this is a masterstroke, right? You cripple the most important port on one of the most important ports on the Eastern Seaboard. It backs up and alters the entire logistical hub for the entire Boston to Washington megalopolis here in the United States. It's incredibly big. A whole I-95 corridor, guys, is I can't overstate how important it is. It stretches from in importance from Boston to Miami. Okay. It's that road. Okay. There's no other road arguably in the world that's more important than I-95. Right. And now we've completely trashed that. There's how many multiple ports or piers serviced behind the Francis Scott Key Bridge. Moreover, it's the Francis Scott Key Bridge.
Tom, if you don't mind, for me being a Canadian, what's the importance?
The guy who wrote the Star Spangled freaking Banner, I was just about to say. Like, if you don't get the fucking symbolism, like, I'm sorry. So you've got the Russians on the one hand, perfectly reasonable, cheap, hack the boat, send it into the pylon. The videos I watched that morning, I stopped watching videos of it after I got my initial impression of it. I'm good. I see the boat on fire, loses power twice, heads right into the pylon. That's it. Bridge goes down. I'm like, I saw that. I watched that five times. I'm like, I'm done. I know the story that I've got here. Everything else they're going to try and tell me about this is a lie. Now, if the FBI comes out that morning and says this was an accident, one of two things here. They're covering for the Russians because they don't want this to be a Russian attack on U.S. soil, thereby escalating this to World War III immediately. Or they're trying to cover for British perfidy, trying to goad us into believing the story that the Russians would even get revenge for what happened in Moscow. Because now when we turn to Moscow...
Before we turn to Moscow...
This is important. I gotta draw this. This is very important. Because I give these people credit all the time. My community is amazing. Okay, so by the next morning after Moscow happens, I get a translation of a Russian journalist. I can't remember his name, and I couldn't pronounce it even if I tried. Explaining the Tajik, MI6, ISIS-K connection in grave detail. And then we find out that the Turks were involved in these guys' training and all the rest of it. This was clearly an operation by mercenaries who were professional, who didn't shoot themselves in the head when they were finished screaming Allahu Akbar on their way to the 77 virgins in heaven waiting for them. This was an operation it was a military intelligence op in every way. Could the Ukrainians have been behind it? Of course. Were they working with other people on this? Of course. But again, who provides that level of logistical support? Where does the money come from? How does the money flow? The way I described this to my patrons the other day was, and I'm sorry. And so before I even get into that, and how did we respond to this? We said it was ISIS. Again, as a cover story. Because I firmly believe the United States powers that be, there is a major faction, I've been saying this for months, that do not want war with the Russians. But if you look at what's been happening over the 2.5 to 3 months of 2024 in the lead up to this, and the fact that we can't get any aid for Ukraine passed through our Congress, the level of histrionics, the level of rhetoric coming out of continental Europe and the British and the United Kingdom has been off the freaking charts to a level that betrays everything I've been saying for 3 years. Europe wants the Americans to fight, be it the British and or the continental Europeans. They both, old colonial powers, want the United States to fight Russia in a war to the death that weakens both of them. So it's the only thing that fits all the damn facts that this is about, that this is not the Russians responding. It's because Putin would never do this, knowing full well he would never strike American soil, knowing full well what our response would be if it was traced back to that. Never. He's only prosecuted the Ukraine war in such a way as to minimize American escalatory response for 2 years. So it would be unbelievably out of character. And who wants everyone to believe that Putin is Putler? The same people who drove Hitler freaking crazy to attack in both directions in 1939, 1940. History rhymes, folks, because the actors don't freaking change. And these people are very smart. They're not very clever. They use the same tactics over and over and over again. So that's where I am on all this. You guys take it from there.
I was just going to ask, from a Canadian standpoint, what's the importance of Baltimore, that bridge? You've mentioned a bunch of different things, but I'm like, you know, why can't, like, to me, I'd never, it's not like I'd ever thought of Baltimore before. You know, if you're going to knock out a bridge in the United States, I guess I'd never paid attention, one. Right. But two, I'm like, what is the significance of Baltimore? Like, why does it matter so much? to the East Coast.
It is a massive port. Like one third of the city of Baltimore is indirectly or directly services the port. It's employed by the port. It's a warm water port. It everything flows through it. Our military logistics to Europe flow through it. Our coal, most of our coal exports flow through it. Like it's just as Alex described in his opening statement, and he's correct. And then everything coming out of those ports and into the I-95 transportation network, like that's the logistical hub of the East Coast of the United States.
So then I go, you know, to me, not knowing all that, I look at it and I go, Baltimore Bridge, like, you know, until I look it up on a map and see where it is. And, you know, yeah. I go, maybe it was an accident. But when I listen to you two, you know, and this is why bringing you on is so important. Bringing you on, it's like, well, maybe it could have been an accident, except for the fact that it's like one of the most key points. It hit the right support. It sped mm-hmm. up. It did all these things, and the FBI came out, and the Daily Mail, and you go, this is it all over again. This just keeps playing out. You know, for the 12th time for you boys coming on, I feel like every second time there's an event that happens right before I have you come on that you're like, all these things don't line up like this. This isn't how the world works.
Right.
Yeah. I assure you I had nothing to do with it. I mean, you know, just so people understand, I wouldn't do such a thing just to have something interesting to say.
Very fair. Very fair.
Very un-British of you, Alex.
Yeah, I was just having a conversation about this off air with just, this is going to sound stupid, but like everyday folk. They're like, oh, did you hear about the Baltimore Bridge? I said, yeah, what a terrible accident. And I'm like, yeah, I'm not.
Unless it wasn't.
Unless yeah, well, exactly my thought. That's why I wanted to talk about it right off the hop. And
it could have been an accident, of course, you know, but one would have to investigate it. I mean, you know, like when a person dies, you investigate. Unless it's obvious why they died, you investigate. You do an autopsy, right? You file some reports. This is just like nothing to see here, folks. Disperse. That's practically the first things that get me to be suspicious, because these people's job is to investigate things. Their job is to be suspicious, right? They should immediately start putting together a list of suspects, and then only once they've eliminated all the suspicions, then they can say, no, this was just an accident. But, you know, like you'd have to interview the pilot, the first officer, whoever was in charge, the pilot, the people who were communicating with the boat as it was sailing off. You'd want to know, you'd want to look through the cargo manifest, what was on board. I mean, there's a lot of things you'd look into before you declare it to be an accident. You couldn't have done it in just a couple of hours. And so, you know, if the FBI comes out with such a categorical statement so quickly, my first thought is like they're covering up something.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then Daily Mail, that reminds me of BBC reporting the World Trade 7 building collapsing 20 minutes before it did.
Right. Right. Exactly. So, I guys, events do not line up like this season.
Yeah.
They just don't. And, you know, when I was watching that video for the first time, I don't know if Alex, if you've ever seen it, I know Sean's never seen it, and you will not be able to find it because it's been scrubbed from the internet. But there's the security cam footage of when Putin's driver died. I don't know if you guys remember this.
Yes.
The security cam footage of what happened with Putin's driver. Putin's limousine was traveling on a major, you know, the major highway, ring highway in Moscow. And there were, and it's, you know, it's like eight, it's like 16 lanes of traffic with no divider between them. So it's like eight lanes this way. And there's like, you know, and flags between the north and southbound traffic or east and westbound traffic. And you, as you're watching this car, you clearly see a puff of smoke from the passenger side, right passenger side front tire here, blows out, and then the car swerves and heads right into the opposite traffic, killing the driver instantly. That car was hacked. The right front brake engaged, and the other one did not, and sent the car into traffic. Putin was supposed to be in that vehicle, and he was not. And the driver died. If they can hack a car to do something like that, they can hack a boat.
One of the WikiLeaks Vault 7 discoveries was that I think since something like 2007, all new cars have electronics in them making them hackable.
Right. Right.
All cars. And I think they developed that already decades earlier. And probably Princess Diana's car was also crashed in this way. You know, it took off out of control. And this is apparently, I mean, I don't know, because, you know, but generally, you know, the suspicion is that this is how she was assassinated, by hacking her car. And then Michael Hastings, his Mercedes also was apparently hacked. This is how he was killed. And so, you know, vehicles in general, if a car can be hacked, then a ship can be hacked.
Oh, and FYI, Putin now only drives around in his Auris, which is a Russian source top to bottom limousine, and he just gave one to Xi Jinping.
Yes, yes. And so,
if you think that those chips are hackable, those cars are hackable by outside forces, I'm sure that they are hardened.
Yeah, you're going to have to learn how to code in Cyrillic.
Among other things, and have to code Russian chips with Russian operating systems and operating instructions and the whole nine yards. We're not talking about chips that, you know, they bought off the shelf that have, you know, that have NSA backdoors and Five Eyes backdoors into them. Okay. These are important bits of information. Okay.
Yes.
It's part of the reason why, you know, the EU wants to open up the Apple App Store and all the rest. They want to be able to sideload their own apps and jailbreak the phones and all the rest of it. And without anybody's knowledge, this is very important. And it's been the EU that's been pushing the data to open up the Apple system. Google's system has always been hackable because Android's a piece of shit. And I'm not a huge fan of iOS either, but from this perspective, Apple's products are far more secure. They're not secure, but they are far more secure to long-term government hacking, which is also why I think the DOJ went after Apple the other day along the same lines for antitrust violations. The whole purpose is to open up the App Store.
Forgive me, Tom. When you say the DOJ went after Apple, can you just expand on that for me?
They filed a lawsuit against Apple for anti-competitive practices, again, over the App Store. I didn't go much farther into it than that. I saw the headline. I've been following the story in Europe for years. My partner Dexter White has forgotten more about Apple than I will ever learn in my lifetime. Having been, in his case, an Apple fanboy for, I don't know, most of the time that we've been friends, which is like going back to when we were both in college and at Air. So, this is one of those things. I will put up his analysis about Apple against any Wall Street analyst, and I'll bet with him and win far more often than anybody else. And he follows this stuff religiously. And so I take his word on this stuff, you know, he's a trusted source, period. So, on this stuff, this is about Apple, and Apple has a culture that is far more resistant to this nonsense. They can't resist everything because of the legal structures that they operate within. Okay, this is not saying that, you know, Apple iPhones are quote unquote secure, but there is a better culture of your data privacy within Apple than there isn't any other major tech company. This is not to say they're good. This is just to say that they are better. Okay. And given the opportunity, they will tend to side with their users until forced to by a governmental entity. Okay. And they will drag it out for as long as possible. And they will spend a lot of money to drag it out for as long as possible. And they have. And their record on this is very clear.
Going back to the massacre in Russia, Alex, do you share the same connection that Tom had put out right at the start? As Tom was talking there, I just didn't really put it together side by side, the time frame of when both happened and how closely they happened. And I don't know, you sit on the other side of the pond, curious your thoughts on the news coming out of Russia and everything else.
I think that the Russians are playing their cards close to the vest now. It's hard to know how they will respond to this, but I'll tell you something that I know kind of secondhand, but I think it's probably not far off from the truth. But when terror attacks happen in Russia, and they find out who the terrorists are, They don't just arrest them and bring them to trial. Their whole family goes. They get everybody. Okay? So, they've gone as far as suggesting that it was that the United States and Britain and possibly France were responsible for this. You know, maybe not directly involved, but they train these people. These people are part of their network. ISIS is Obama's creation. The leaving the weapons caches prepared for acts of terror is the model of Gladio. Gladio is creation of NATO. So, If I were Jake Sullivan, Victoria Nuland, Robert Kagan, all of these people, Mike Morrell, I'd take real good care of my family's security right now, because nothing's going to happen immediately probably, but they might be coming for them.
I didn't know that about Russia and all the family.
That's something that I heard unofficially. Nobody's going to tell you this officially, but Russia did have a few terror events in the immediate aftermath of the Chechen wars, and then they stopped cold, even though there's Russia is full of these Dagestani people and Tajiks. It would be very easy for any of them to infiltrate Russia, as they have. They have whole communities of Tajiks there. This is the only way to discourage them, because these people don't care. They're going to do this. They're going to sacrifice themselves. They're going to die in the process. But if they know for certain that their death means also the death of their mother, father, cousins, daughters, sisters, then it's a different equation, different calculus. So just don't do it. Don't do it, because your whole family goes. And, when you think about it, it could be the case. It could be that this is how they deal with terror. And so they're going to deal with the Tajiks and their families if this is the case. But, if they connect this to MI6 and the CIA, you had Victoria Nuland saying that the Russians, the Putin's going to have some nasty surprises. Well, how close was she with the handlers of these people? Mm-hmm. You had Mike Morrell speaking to 60 Minutes saying, what we got to do is we got to kill more Russians. We have to go out and kill Russians. Well, now Russians got killed. So, is Mike Morrell plugged into these networks? I think that the Russians are going to find out maybe they already know, and maybe they're already prepared to send a strong message. Don't do this again. And don't count on, you know, walking off into the sunset like, oh, it was ISIS. I had nothing to do with this. And then the Russians are going to say like, oh, okay, I guess if you had nothing to do with this, then we just move on. It's not the Russian way. That's you know, right. This was understood a long time ago. You know, it was Germany's first chancellor, Otto von
Bismarck.
Yeah. Otto von Bismarck, who said, if you're dealing with Russians, deal straight or don't deal at all. Because if you think you're going to screw them, they're going to come after you. They're going to come for you.
So an interesting point about Victoria Nuland and her warning to the Russians. I read some stuff about this and some theorizing and some. This was the argument I've heard. And again, salt this to taste, is that this thing was originally supposed to go off on March 7th. Timed with, I think, the State of the Union address here in the United States. And again, the right people in the U.S. got wind of this and put the kibosh on it at that moment. And that's why the U.S. State Department issued the letter publicly saying, stay away from concert halls and all the rest of it. Because that was our signal to the Russians. Look, this thing is happening. We didn't know about it. It's, and blah, be warned. It didn't happen. Nuland is then fired. She doesn't resign from the State Department. She's fired.
Do you know that do you know that for sure, Tom?
Let me put it to you this way. Go read Alexander Mercurius over at The Duran did a great job of parsing the language of Anthony Blinken's statement about Victoria
Nuland. Oh, okay.
And what he said, and Alex's read on this, I think it's very clear, is that one, in that letter, Blinken did not thank Toria for her service and her decades of service to the State Department. And he said, she's retired. He used the phrase retired, not resigned.
Okay.
So she was moved out. Now, and then we have, you know, the pro-China crowd moved into her place. So she lost the power struggle within the State Department. The, by all accounts, the operation, the Ukrainian counteroffensive or offensive from last year, which failed, was her operation. She was, for all intents and purposes, let's put it this way. The best way to describe all this is that in movie speak, Nuland was the director of this project, Project Ukraine. Probably the director of this attack on Russian civilians in the concert hall. And this was supposed to go off before the Russian elections. I believe that the British, and to a lesser extent, their people within our intelligence services who are ideologically aligned, were the unit production manager, the stage manager, the set designer, and all of that. Clearly, the Turks were the casting directors, but everybody was a producer with points on the gross. Okay? And I think you can make the same argument about the Nord Stream pipeline bombing, adding in now the Poles and the Finns and this one and that one. But someone was actually coordinating all of this. And I believe the bits of the executive producer doing all the actual coordination. Nuland may be the director, but the Brits and MI6 are definitely the producers on this because it's their handiwork. It's their MO. It's the way they operate at every level. They've been exposed dozens of times doing it this way, right? And I think Nuland was removed not just in an internal power struggle as we theorized at the time, but it was that this was the final straw. This was where she was stage managing and directing an operation that was going to lead to an uncontrolled escalatory framework that would put the United States and Russia in direct conflict on behalf of foreign powers. This will not stand.
You see, here's the crazy thing about this tome.
What's that?
That's a crazy thing about this tome, because I think that the original terror attack was intended to happen just before the election.
Yes.
To disrupt it. So it was supposed to happen on the 7th of March.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And the 7th of March was the concert in the same place of the guy named Shaman, who is like, mm-hmm. whatever, 21st century Russian version of Bruce Springsteen.
Right.
And apparently the security was super tight. So these guys turned up and they thought like, can't be done. And they aborted the mission.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say you orchestrated all this, but it didn't happen because either the Russians took precautions or they heeded the warning that the Americans gave. So the whole thing of disrupting the elections didn't happen, right?
Right.
So who decided to do it anyway just for gratuitous killing? Because the election is over.
But the same people, because they're the same ones.
So why do it then? Why was it?
Because again, now it's not our State Department that did it. Now it makes even more sense that it came from Europe. It came from the British, who were desperate to try and get the United States and Putin to act in a, it's like if you can get Putin to act off, you know, on tilt, using a poker metaphor. Which they've been trying to do for 2.5 years, and it won't work. And he escalates. He does. He goes and he Kinzhal strikes against NATO headquarters. No NATO headquarters in Ukraine. You know, they're getting ready to move on Kharkov. Got it. I mean, all this stuff is happening, right? And then the bridge. And then we get the ship pushed into the bridge, which, yeah. You know, after everybody and their brother took one look at what happened in Moscow and went, clearly that was a CIA op. Because we've been conditioned now to think it was a CIA op. Meanwhile, the Americans and NATO issue a profound, unequivocal apology or letter of condolence to the Russians for the first time in how long over this attack. And yet the fucking British, Jeremy Hunt goes out there and says, we can't trust anything the British, the Russians say. They lie about everything. No contrition, no notes of condolences coming out of anybody. Not David Cameron, not Rishi Sunak, nobody. Not a fucking word from these people. Same thing out of Europe. Nothing. NATO, yes. The United States, yes. Not continental Europe. These people are exposing themselves, if you've got eyes to see and ears to listen, every freaking day, that this is their war that they want, again, us to fight. Just like it was World War I, just like fucking World War II, and everybody's been standing around for months now saying, there's no reason for this conflict. Rational actors, rational commentators and analysts and everybody is going, why in the hell are we going to war with the Russians? This makes no damn sense. Ah, cooler heads will prevail. This is all just posturing, blah, 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 blah. They said the same goddamn thing leading up to World War I. The same things were said then. And yet, here we are. Okay? So, like, it's the same people. It's the same modus operandi. It's the same incentives, it's the same stuff. It's just another iteration of the same thing. And the Americans are looking at this going, this is not in our best interest.
Yeah, yeah.
At all. And yet somehow, I mean, even Biden is looking at this and going, this is not good. And so you have to ask yourself, who benefits from these two acts? And the United States doesn't benefit at all.
Yeah.
The Russians don't benefit at all. The Chinese don't benefit, really. And so the simple revenge model and doesn't work. Not when Joseph Borrell, the foreign minister for the EU, literally comes out earlier this week and says, look, cards on the table. We don't love Ukraine. We don't love Ukrainians. We're not interested in Ukraine for Ukraine and Ukrainians. That's all nonsense. We're there because of geopolitical and geostrategic interests for Europe, and that's it. He finally actually dispensed with all the bullshit. We finally saw a Western diplomat tell the truth. Like, the masks are coming off, folks. They're rubbing our noses in it. They're arrogant and they're obnoxious and they don't care. And I've been banging my shoe on the table like Khrushchev for 2 years going, the Americans don't want this. There are forces within America that do want it, of course. There are players in the banking system that want this, but there is a growing faction of American leadership that is like, this is insane.
Yeah.
What in the actual fuck are we doing?
Yeah. This again goes back to the reason why my suspicion is, my top spot on the list of suspects would be the City of London and people who work for them, because one thing I've been kind of thinking about is how you create this process of Nazification that happened in Germany during the 1930s and that happened in Ukraine after 2014. And you start by destroying the nation's economy. You know, you immiserate people, you create this dry tinder of young men who have no way to reach their aspirations, right? And then you kind of start blaming everything on a designated enemy, and you start creating the war psychosis. And then all you need is a spark, a false flag attack. And then you say like, oh, look, it was the Russians or it was the Chinese or whoever you want to go to war against. And so now, you know, the City of London is losing their empire. They're sensing that the United States is losing interest in being their global cop. And now what do you have to do? You have to create their, you practically lost the war fighting to the last Ukrainian. We're getting to that grim milestone now. And now you need new cannon fodder. And you need a much, much bigger bludgeon against Russia, because Ukraine wasn't big enough. And so why not now get the United States into this position, and also Poland and Germany and the Baltic states and Finland and Sweden and Romania and Bulgaria and Czech Republic and everybody. So you start sabotaging their economies. You start destroying their economies, and you start talking about conscription, and you start, both Viktor Orban after visiting in Brussels and Robert Fico, they both came out and they were like, oh my God, these people are talking like all they want to do is go to war. Like Brussels is already in the war psychosis.
Yes.
Where is it coming from? Well, you know, one thing we know is that a lot of the European officials are actually George Soros loyalists. And who does George Soros work for? You talked with Richard Poe. He worked it out really well. Mm-hmm. And it goes back to the City of London. They're trying to hide it, but they left enough breadcrumbs where, you know, maybe you cannot make a conclusive case, but there's enough breadcrumbs leading back to the City of London that should be your top suspect, and you should investigate that. And then, you know, if you came up with a list of alternative suspects, it gets really thin.
Oh, doesn't
and,
it?
And the case would be very flimsy. And who would gain from a major war between the United States and Russia and all these European nations in Russia is really like not clear. Like the states don't, well, you went over it, Tom. States don't have a lot to gain from it. To the contrary, they would have a lot to gain in trading with Russia, right? Western European nations, Eastern European nations don't have anything to gain either. But that little parasite, the Golden Mile, what is it called? Is it the Golden Mine or
yeah,
whatever.
Something like that.
the Rotten Mile. That's who gains everything or loses everything in this equation.
Yep. Now, what's interesting, Alex, I'm not in any way, manner, shape, or form disagreeing with you, because yes, for those of you who don't know, you should listen to the podcast I did with the two podcasts I've done with Richard Poe. The last one was episode 171 of the Gold, Ghosts, and Guns podcast, and then the other one is like it's linked in 171. So you should listen to both of those, because Richard's work on this has been impeccable. But it's interesting that there was an article I saw this morning saying that Lloyd's of London stands to lose billions in the Baltimore Bridge attack from lost shipping insurance. And they've been one of the major vectors. And so this is like laying some evidence on the fact that the Russians would have been behind this to attack City of London. Because at the same time, we now bring the Houthis in the Red Sea, and they're clearly targeting British shipping insurance. You guys have to realize that what's left of the British Empire can literally be like encapsulated in British shipping interests and their insurance and reinsurance companies. Right? Why does anybody give a shit about the British pound? Because it settles 30% of the world's financial transactions.
Well, and also when everybody was benchmarking to LIBOR, then they had a role, but that got taken away from them as
right.
well.
That got taken away too. We talked about that on this podcast at least three or four times, right?
Yeah. So it seems that it's shrinking rapidly.
Yeah.
So they're panicked.
Yeah.
And they are probably the ones who are most inclined to do panicky acts, because exactly. Everybody else has maneuvering space. The United States has massive maneuvering space. The Chinese have maneuvering space. Yes. The Iranians don't need any of this.
Right.
You know, they have a different game.
Right.
And so that, I think, you know, whatever, however you slice and dice this, the City of London comes on top of the list of suspects. We can't say that it's them, but they should be investigated. They're, you know, the means, the methods.
And the opportunity. Motive, means, and opportunity.
Yeah.
It's where it starts. No, I agree, Alex. Absolutely. No, I mean, well said. And I'm happy to, you know, I may be a dog with a bone here that I won't let go. And this may be, you know, I may be a hammer looking for nails. I'm okay with that. But I can tell you one thing and one thing alone. There ain't one goddamn subject that I get more open pushback on in public and from my own people than the idea that the British are still running all of these things. And I'm sorry, but those who you truly cannot criticize,
yes,
are the ones that actually rule you. And it's 90% of the bullshit about Israel. I am not in any way, manner, shape, or form absolving Israel of their crimes, and there are many.
So,
when you saw Israel is a false flag.
I'll read you a paragraph from this book.
Mm-hmm.
So, you all know who Alfred Milner was.
Refresh our memory, Alex, just to make sure everybody's on.
Alfred Milner was in at the turn of the century, head of the British, think tank, the Milner's Round Table, Milner's Kindergarten. Right, he was running the British foreign policy. He was the man who was responsible for the Boer Wars and for orchestrating World War I. And so, from the Manchester Guardian in November 1915, the recruits of the so-called Kindergarten-Milner's Club, also known as the Round Table, intimated that, quote unquote, the whole future of the British Empire as a sea empire depended upon Palestine becoming a buffer state inhabited by, under quotation marks, by an intensely patriotic race. Then you get the Balfour Declaration, right? And then you have the ceding of Palestine with an intensely patriotic race. But it's coming from the freaking city of London. Mm-hmm.
Yep. What book, Alex, in case people are interested in reading it?
A Conjuring Hitler by a author is Guido Giacomo Preparata. This book is an absolute masterpiece. I cannot recommend it highly enough because it's history. But the man figured out the role of money creation, of central banks, of Montagu Norman, of Hjalmar Schacht, these central bankers who were in charge when World War I, World War II were being orchestrated and funded, and where the funding was coming from, and how the British democracy works, and all of it. And he puts it on in a very, very tight, extremely compelling case. It's an interpretation, but it's based on very good research. And, well, you know, Ramsay MacMullan said, you know, you can't write history unless you look into the motivations of groups and people who hold the reins of power. And so it doesn't, you know, like it doesn't help to say like, well, there was this battle and that armistice and resolution and blah, 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 and one damn thing after another, unless you investigate what ties all these events together. Who was running the show? Who was benefiting from the show? For what reason? What the strategy was? And so this book, of all the books I've read about the events at the beginning of the 20th century and through World War One and through World War One and World War Two, this I think is the most brilliant and most compelling books on the subject that I've. And it's not big, you know, like if you read Carol Quigley, you have to be ready to work through 1,400 pages. This is much, much more condensed, but it's punchy as hell. It runs to 268 pages. And I've nothing to do with it. I'm not plugging my own work, but this
No. The fact you're reading it and there's something very compelling. There's a lot of people who listen to you too. And anytime you bring up something that's influencing how you think about history in the world of today, they want to read it themselves, right? Experience it firsthand. I told you boys an hour. We're closing in on an hour. Any final thoughts, and I'll let you both out of here so you can get on with your days. And I know it's, thanks Alex for hopping on. I'm sure it's, starting to give, you know, when it's this late in the day, appreciate you giving us some time and same to you, Tom, you've both been very generous, but, any final thoughts here in the last couple of minutes before I let you both go?
Yes. Just a quick one, Sean. Thank you very much for doing what you're doing, because I think that the most important thing for us to do at this really, really tense moment in history is to keep speaking up, to keep working out what's going on, and to keep sharing the ideas, the information, the insights. People who hear this and process this will also share their feedback. And, you know, it's kind of panning for gold. We've been led blind to slaughter twice in the last century. And I think that this is the way for us to keep our eyes wide open and to keep alert and to push back, to defend peace and keep these schemes perpetually sabotaged, and then to ultimately kill the beast by, you know, 100 million cuts or a billion cuts or, you know,
yep.
So that's my final thought. And I would also like to add that I'm very convinced that we actually are doing this and that their schemes are failing left and right it's not working. But we have to keep it up. We have to keep doing it.
No, agreed. Everything Alex has said, I think, is incredibly important. I would echo all those sentiments. And yes, we are winning small battles here. They are undeterred. These are people, I just want to remind everybody, that they don't submit to any higher power. They don't submit to any, they believe they are masters of the universe. And they are, at the same time, pot committed on the path that they're on. Jim Kunstler in the podcast I just did before I hopped on with you guys kept asking the question, if they know this isn't working, why are they continuing to do it? Because they don't have any other options.
Yeah.
Once you're so far down a particular path, you have a zero percent chance of not being strung up by your toenails and fed to dogs if you admit to what you've done, and you have a non-zero probability. Positive probability that you can somehow skate your way out of this. You're always, so every time you're going to choose that path. That's where they are. It doesn't help. It doesn't help that they all have massive superiority complexes, because they've always been able to manipulate us into these things in the past. But we have communications tools that are now light years ahead of where we've ever been in the past. And it's the double-edged sword of technology. They can use it against us to create false realities, and they can also lose control because reality breaks through.
Yep.
Lies are expensive and the truth sells itself, folks.
Yep.
So none of us are here saying, as Alex said, that anything we've presented today is gospel truth. We're giving you our best probability clouds of what's going on here. And that's the world we live in. We live in a quantum universe, folks. It ain't Newtonian. It's not force equals mass times acceleration. It's, well, kind of, you know, celestial mechanics only works at a very large, on large systems. But for the most part, we are quantum creatures. We exist in probability clouds of deductive reasoning. So, and our own biases. So salt it all to taste. And I hope you enjoyed it.
Thanks for hopping on, gents. I just thought I would tuck this in for anyone wanting to see you in Lloydminster on April 27th. Since we started, we've already sold another ticket, so there's 23 left. So, you know, if anyone is sitting there going, these guys are going to be in Lloyd, what's going on? There's a whole cast of characters coming to Lloydminster April 27th. Tom and Alex are two of them, and hope to see you there. But it's looking like she's going to be sold out here pretty darn quick, which is super cool. To pack a building and have a full day. It is a full day. This one, it is a forum. It starts at 9 a.m. It's going to go till after supper. Lunch is involved, and certainly a lot of conversation with these two guys and others.
Brilliant. I really very much look forward to it, Sean. Thank you.
So do I. Absolutely. And look us all up when you're there.